This is VIX, a biographical series made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and produced by Miami University Radio. Bix Beiderbecke approached the end of his recording career in September of 1930. The Great Depression lay heavy over the country. Musicians found employment scarce. Hoagie Carmichael gathered a group of jazz musicians for a recording session at the Victor Studios on September 15th. Boyce Cullen, Irving Brodsky, and Eddie Lang were included for this session, as well as the men named by Frank Powers.
Ray Ludwig being present, but in this case, Jack Teagarden was on trombone, Jimmy Dorsey, Arnold Brillhart, Bud Freeman, Pee Wee Russell, Min Lee Brook again, and Joe Venuti. Chauncey Morehouse of the Goldkit Band is a drummer on this particular recording, however. The number is George on My Mind. This is a composition of Hoagie, and near the end of the recording, Bix plays a beautiful chorus. His last recording, he was failing. He seems to falter at times, but does he really? I would wonder how many jazz trumpet players would give many years of their life for the opportunity to have made the statement that Bix makes on this record. A very few bars at the end of the record, but very beautiful and very meaningful.
And so, Hoagie Carmichael's well-known Georgia was first recorded with the composer doing the vocal work.
Marvelous epitaph for Bix is that the last thing he played is so beautiful. Bix Beiderbecke was a man and he was a musician, but it is very hard for the people who have studied his work and who have listened to his recordings with worship to separate him from the God figure they have created. This was an imperfect boy, torn by the changes of social values of his time. He is so unique that there is only one character in the history of jazz which can be compared to him, and that is Charlie Parker. The imperfections of Bix Beiderbecke's personality are possibly the true key to his genius. These are responsible for making him a legendary anachronism.
After a summer on radio's Camel Pleasure Hour, Bix suffered yet another collapse. He went back to Davenport in October, and there he resumed his friendship with Les Swanson. Mr. Swanson recalls some of their activities of that winter.
Again, so I'm 10 months later when he showed up with our band, almost unannounced, with Travel Hearn's orchestra at the Moline Eagles Ballroom. I saw very little of him that winter, as the throes of the Depression had deepened and there was very little work for musicians. 30-31 winter. Very modest and unassuming. You wouldn't know he'd ever been in a big time if you didn't know the news regarding him. And he's one of the best fellows I ever met in the music business. He was very easygoing. That's about the best words I could use to describe him.
Bix's brother Charles supports Swanson's story about Bix's modesty and recalls Bix's sobriety in Davenport.
I was in the music business at that time and sold records, and as a result, I have about 24 of his original records. But he never sent us records or anything. Didn't even mention that he'd made any. And the thing that impressed me when he came home, he wouldn't leave Davenport until he had sat in with every band in the city. His friends. They all liked him here locally, the local bands. Glad to see him come. He didn't drink when he was home, to my knowledge. I remember that era.
Spring of 1931 brought Bix Beiderbecke back to New York. Finding work as scarce as ever, Bix settled down to serious attempts at composition. He rented an apartment and called on his friend Bill Chalice for help. Bix's weak point was still notation and reading. Bill Rank, who had been with Bix since the days with Gene Goldkett, remembers the fatigue he noticed in Bix that spring and recalls the business of writing music.
Fortunately, Bix commissioned Bill Chalice to transcribe these things in a mist and candlelight and in the dark and all those things for Robbins Music Corporation in New York. And Bix said he wanted to do something to leave behind after he had gone. Well, like Bill Chalice said.
Now, he worked hard on these compositions. I had only hoped it was a disappointment that it didn't last longer. It could have and would have had he lived. I'm sure, in the circumstances, great. After all, he had to pay his hotel bill. He had to live around New York, you know.
I think he had a premonition that he wasn't going to be long on this earth, because he consistently kept getting tired easily, you know, and didn't have the vitality that he should have to keep going, that these recurrences of rest that he had to have became more frequent as time went on. Bix never complained about anything, but he might have had maybe chest pains or something like that that he didn't say anything about.
The first transcription Bix and Bill Chalice worked out was In a Mist. Bix had recorded this solo on September 9th, 1927 for OK Records. Frank Trombauer reported on the session and how the more familiar title came about.
Well, we made the original recording, and to... Would you like to have me give it to you briefly as to what actually happened the day we made the recording? Well, primarily, we couldn't get this tune on record because Bix didn't have it organized. We had no name for it. It was just something that Bix played. So we tried to record it, and it was too long. We tried again, and it was too short. So after a great deal of planning and much difficulty, we decided that we'd just let Bix play anything that came to his mind and construct this as he went along, and at a given time, I'd tap him on the shoulder, and then he would make an ending, which he did, and the famous closing bars of In a Mist happened after I tapped him on the shoulder, and we came out with a record-length master. In reviewing the master, we realized that we had something very significant, at least we thought we did, but we couldn't find a title for it, and Tommy Rockwell, the recording manager of the OK Company at that time, said, well, this thing is all confused. He says, it's kind of foggy. I said, well, we can't call it fog or haze. And why don't we call it In a Mist? And that's where the title was born. And then we took the tune up to Bill Challis, one of the Whiteman arrangers at that time, and he had the tremendous job of taking that off of the record and making the printed copy. And he and Bix worked together for days getting that down on paper. Then Robbins Music Company took it, published it in the form that you now see it. And I think something tremendous happened in music at that particular time, the day we recorded In a Mist.
Bill Challis had been an arranger for Paul Whiteman at the peak of the band's prosperity in the 20s. He left the organization in June 1930. Much of his time afterwards was spent in helping Bix Beiderbecke prepare his unpublished piano works for the Robbins Music Company. Mr. Challis explains his relationship with Bix and the work involved.
When we got in the Whiteman Orchestra, now Bix played this intermist around the Gold Cat Band. He played the part of it, the first phrase of it he played. He was playing it whenever he'd sit down at the piano. Many of the fellows in the band, they all knew it. And he might play it a little bit differently, ended up a little bit differently. This one particular phrase, but that da 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 da, that part, everybody knew. I mean, all of his friends and the musicians around him knew that. Now then, when we got in the Whiteman Band, there was a fellow by the name of Jack Robbins, the publisher. And they had this this particular series here. Let me maybe I can show it to you. No, this is modern composition for the piano. But there is, on the originals that came out, a Whiteman series. Now, Whiteman was always trying to find a follow-upper for Rhapsody in Blue. So Robbins and Whiteman, they were always on the lookout for different kind of material. So Paul, he was very good about playing. If anybody came around with something that they thought had merit, they'd play it, and then Robbins would publish it. He and Whiteman owned the publishing company. Now then, he came around there one time, and he had heard this In the Mist. So he talked to Bix and said, I'd like you to put it down, and we'll make something out of it. He says, but I think it needs more than what you've got.
I can remember we started in Philadelphia. That would have been in the spring. I think we started about the first part of 1928.
So he got the first part down, or that we got the first part down. Let's see, then there's a second part that Bix, the first and second parts. And then Robbins thought it wasn't enough. He said, it needs a broad strain, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that part of the Rhapsody in Blue. He wanted Bix to write a broad strain, a nice commercial broad strain, melodic strain, to fill it out. He said, then we'll put it out. We will publish it. Now, it didn't take long for Bix to get that. So he was given an assignment. He did it. That's, you know, are you familiar with it? That's the, that's this part, you know. You know, that melodic string. So then it entailed writing that, so we got together and wrote that down. Now we got the whole thing done. It took quite a while between engagements and between other things. But when we got it all set, and they liked it, and then Robbins started to get into him to make another, and then make another. And he made, I think he made Candlelights next. And then you'd find Bix at the piano here and there, and he'd come up with these things. And I thought that had he lived, he would have been off on a composing career. He wasn't a finished piano player by any means. I mean, he wasn't one of these fellows that could go up and down the piano one hand, saying tied behind his back or anything like that. But he sat down to play, and he played off these things. So I think his compositions probably came the same way. He never got around to notating. Although, I tell you, I'd have to give him more credit than most fellows do for reading, because he sure knew if I made a mistake. If I had written something and it wasn't, there was a note wrong, or maybe a rhythmic part that was wrong, because I'd have to write it first. He would play a part over maybe 4 or 6 bars, and I'd say, wait, I can't write it that fast. and we had no tape machines then, he'd say, all right, very patiently, and then I would have to write it as much as I could hear. Then I'd say, play that bar over again, or play that bar over again, or go back and play this passage. And this was, it was a long, tedious job. And I would have mistakes. I'd write them down just like a typist, as fast as I could. And I would make mistakes, too. So when we put them all out, when we worked them all out, if he played it again, I said, look, try it over again. It could very well have come out differently, and he'd like it just as well. Now I said, which way do you want it? And he would play it over, and I would tell him what I had. We would work it out, and this is the way I want it. He was very definite about it. And then he would say at the end no, that's the way I want it. He says, I'll learn to play it that way. So that when he'd sit down to play it, he'd play it that way every time. But knowing Bix, it just wouldn't come out that way.
Jimmy McPartland, who had taken Bix's place with the Wolverines, had kept track of Beiderbecke's career. McPartland was part of two recordings of In a Mist. Jimmy and Marion McPartland state their preference for one version.
I favor the one on the Brunswick album, which was called Shades of Bix. And Marion Marion McPartland played the solo on the theme.
Somewhere, Jimmy has a copy, an autographed copy of that music that Bix autographed to him. Periodically, I learn it in a mist and play it. In fact, I recorded it. And then I sort of forget parts of it, and I have to relearn it. And I'm just in the process of relearning it right now. I thought Bix played it way too fast. And when I first actually did get that tune down to learn it, for my own taste, I slowed it down. And it felt to me like a much more moody piece, you know, and the very title of it, In a Mist. You know, it just seems like you shouldn't rattle it off at top speed.
I had Dick Carey make the arrangement the way that Bix and I talked about it. He took me to a concert at Carnegie Hall, symphony concert at Carnegie Hall one time, and we talked about writing a jazz symphony. Sometime, how wonderful it would be to write a jazz symphony and have the different movements, you know, have an ad lib strain or dolce and slow, you know, and then speed up the tempo and go into a rhythm and then swing, you know, improvise and so forth. So I said, well, gee, you know, as a matter of fact, In a Mist is like that. I said, I'd love to hear In a Mist with bassoons and oboes. And he's here, right. He said, that's right. You know, I said, give it the color of In a Mist, you know, in the moors and the mist over in Scotland or someplace, and it's all foggy. And so when I told Dick Carey about, you know, the conversation I had with Bix regarding In a Mist, and I told him how to treat it. And we did it. So I had English horn, I believe, bassoon, oboes, and the regular band, which is, oh, I don't know, Cutty Cutchill and Peanuts Hucko, and I've forgotten the exact, George Wedding was on there, and Dick Carey, Marion played the piano solo.
And though illness, fatigue, and financial problems sapped Bix's ability to play his cornet, they did not quell his creative drive. Bix channeled this constant drive through the piano. His compositions began to add to his recordings as a legacy for the jazz world. This is Bix, a biographical series made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Consultants for the series were John Steiner, along with Joseph Campbell and Philip Evans. Commentary was recorded by Frank Powers. Continuity was written by Mary Kay Fulton. Audio engineer, Michael J. McGuire. Bix was researched, produced, and directed by Jim Grover. This is Bill Utter speaking for Miami University Radio.
Limited rights for this rebroadcast of Bix on WMKV 89.3 FM Cincinnati were given by WMUB-FM, Miami University Broadcasting in Oxford, Ohio, courtesy of WMUB-FM General Manager Cleve Callison. WMUB-FM originally produced the program for broadcast in 1971. Any rebroadcast, internet streaming, or archiving of this program by anyone other than WMKV is prohibited. WMKV would like to thank the original producer of the program, Jim Grover, for his vision and efforts to preserve this unique chapter in the history of jazz, authored by Bix, and Mr. Bill Utter, Director Emeritus of Miami University Broadcasting, who conceived the original program idea, narrated the original series, and has been instrumental in making this rebroadcast possible. Dave Bartholomew, volunteer and host of the WMKV weekly program Friction, deserves special thanks for his labor of love in remastering Bix. The advisory group that oversaw the project to rebroadcast Bix include Frank Powers, commentator on the original series, Dave Bartholomew, Bill Utter, Cleve Callison, WMUB General Manager, Dave Schramm, WMKV Coordinator of Online Services, Mike Farrar, WMKV Coordinator of Production Services, Joe Schooner, WMKV Intern from the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, Media Division, and Alan Vyosky, WMKV General Manager. Please stay tuned for the best in big band era music right here on WMKV, the way radio was meant to be.